This podcast has been produced by Fat Cat Productions. Check them out at fatcatprods.com. That's FATCATPRODS.com. For all of your audio and video production needs, reach out to Jeff at Fat Cat Productions. Hey everyone, it's Alex and this is Dialogue. Today I'm speaking with Liz Simpson, the founder of Stimulus, a sales consultancy based out of San Antonio, Texas, that helps B2B service firms drive new business growth through a business development system rooted in emotional intelligence, business acumen, and high-value relationship building. She's helped service-based clients close as much as 2 million, or a little over 2 million actually, of new business in just 18 months and a record 600,000 in 1 month. She's been featured in NBC, CBS, NPR, Essence Magazine, and San Antonio Business Journal's 40 Under 40. She's an advisory board member for Together in Digital and an inaugural Lifetime Fellow of Inbound. Her company's core competency centers on providing a proven business development approach that consistently fills the pipeline with new potential clients. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much, and welcome to Dialogue. I'm thrilled that you are available, and like we were talking before we hit record, I think it's a big, huge topic, provided the gig economy and freelancers, and I want to just jump right in and dive into that. Thank you again for being here. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's jump right in, Liz. Love to just start with a question on sharing more about yourself here for our listeners and how you got to be so great at sales.
Thank you. So I actually spent 10 years in corporate sales, so I'm that person who's been in almost every sales role from call centers, door-to-door, retail, and then I graduated into more outpatient medical sales. And I worked for amazing organizations that provided really world-class sales training. So I didn't wake up like this. This is 10 years of sales training and other organizations investing in me for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier, and we can certainly delete this if you don't want to include it, but about, you know, corporate burnout. And tell me a little bit about what took you from, you know, learning and world-class training into where you are today.
Sure. I think that's a critical part of my story because it's really impacted my approach today to sales and the people that I work with. So I spent 10 years in corporate sales, and I woke up really transparently on my 30th birthday, and I had checked the boxes of what I perceived success was going to look like, and I realized I just didn't feel fulfilled. And I was really burnt out in my role at that time, and in my last corporate sales role, it felt very all-consuming. Consumed most of my time. In some sales roles, it feels like you're always on. And so I just was looking for more fulfillment in my life and the next step. And I realized that all of this time that I've been chasing this definition of success for 10 years, I really had not taken the time to really figure out who I was, how I evolved as a person, and what fulfillment really looked like for me. I always say that success is not one size fits all. You have to find your own tailor-made version of it. So that evolved into me leaving corporate and then working with other entrepreneurs and business leaders and realizing that sales really was a needed skill set for most practitioners in business. They're passionate about the thing that they're an expert at. They're passionate about the service they provide. But 99% of the time, people are not passionate about sales. However, that's what keeps the lights on.
That's well said, really well said, you know, and I think there's a couple of key themes already popping. What success feels like and sort of plotting that or creating a system, you know, making a list and seeing what's working and what's not based on where you thought you'd be. You know, we're going to talk about proven business development and what that means, but, you know, looking back and creating some credentials to check against, I think, is imperative. And then passionate about sales and what you're passionate about. I love that as well, and I think that's truly part of your story from the conversations that we've had. And we admit talked before about, you know, not doing what you're passionate about. So, all right, we're in freelance land and we're doing contract work and what we're having to do, you know, all of this, a lot more sales, a lot more networking, a lot more you know, X, Y, and Z instead of the primary passion point of the consulting or specialization work. So I think that's a key thing as well, is about passion and how to stay aligned. I think at the end of the day, you know, as far as takeaways, is how to get perhaps on that line of passion or to get back aligned with the passion point of being a freelancer, because it's so important as to why people, you know, got started in that space in the first place.
Pivot that goes with that, because typically when I talk to people and when they do have an aversion to sales, it's because of what they perceive sales to be. So a lot of times my work is helping them to redefine and truly understand what effective, healthy sales looks like. And most times when people better understand what sales should look like, as opposed to like this negative stereotype that many people perceive, then it oftentimes better aligns with what they're passionate about. But most people are passionate about, here's my skill set, I love my skill set, and I want to help other people with this, or I want to solve this problem for other people. Most people I talk to have a tendency to want to do good for others, and that's why they have an aversion to sales, because they perceive sales as the opposite of doing good. They perceive sales as putting my agenda on someone else, regardless of what their needs are. And so when I actually help them to see that, no, it's quite the opposite. The most effective salespeople actually are focused on aligning their outcomes with the needs of their buyers, and it's really serving and helping. Then that helps them to really realign it with what they're passionate about in the first place.
Yeah. We talked about the U and USP as the first point earlier, and we're going to get to that in a minute a bit more, but that piece is so important. You know, the Venn diagram with two circles of you and then your client, and to state that, plan for that, so you know where there's a fit or where there's not a fit. You know, I think sometimes like knowing who your client is, or who your client is not, rather, is sometimes more important than knowing who your client is. You know, the flip of the coin for context. Let's keep going on the futures freelance. So we're going to dive again into future freelance. Want to dive in even more into building value-based relationships. So perhaps that's more about the connectivity there. And then we've got some questions about the proven business development approach, focusing in on proven there. Because I know as freelancers, especially as a specialist in strategy, you know, all about metrics and numbers in a lot of cases. So I want to get to that. But when we first connected to chat about the idea of this dialogue, we both were sparked at the idea of tailoring it for freelancers. And the number of freelancers totally continues to grow. I pulled a quote here from Freelancing in America. This is a 2019 study, and it was Upwork and Freelancers Union's sixth annual study of the U.S. freelance workforce composition. I can include a link, but basically the numbers are increasing significantly. The share of full-time freelancers increased from 17% in 2014 to 28% in 2019. And the most common type of freelance work is skilled services, with 45% of freelancers providing skills such as programming, marketing, and consulting. So really, you know, skilled specialized services is kind of leading the edge, if you will, with, you know, 45% again being, you know, specialist and skilled services. So let's set the table a little bit. What percentage of your business, because I know you work with small, medium, and large, what percentage of your business would you say comes from independent contractors?
Yeah, so I call them the expert practitioners. Absolutely. I would say a good 30 to 40% of my business comes from expert practitioners, individuals who offer a service, and they've built a business around it.
That's huge. That's great to know. I think there's a point where you sort of have to say, okay, I need some help here, or this is where I'm lagging.
Right, absolutely. So I'm seeing a increasing younger demographic that I ever saw before. It's surprising for me. It caused me about a year and a half ago to really better understand younger generations and their passions. So I'm excited to see an increasing amount of younger millennial women. For about 10 to 12 years of my career, I was always doing business with men. It's really only been in the past several years that I've worked more with women business owners and women practitioners, so that's something that I'm excited about. Marketing, I mean, social media, marketing, branding, advertising, those typically are individuals who are drawn to me, but that are trying, that typically aren't accustomed to business development conversations. And what I hear a lot is they struggle to quantify the value of what they offer, therefore they struggle with selling, positioning it, and pricing it.
It's like pulling back the curtain on what we do as a strategist. It's turn the mirror around or put the mirror towards you to see. And how wonderful, because my network is largely marketing, branding, and advertising folks. Not only freelancers, but, you know, B2B and advertisers and marketers directly as well. So that's great. Want to talk about kind of the tangibleness of those clients, if you will. And curious if there's years of being in business, a milestone that you can talk to that freelancers should know about, that you're seeing from your lens and from your point of view, that freelancers should know about in terms of goal setting for dialing in sales efforts?
Mm-hmm. From my experience, I don't have a year's benchmark. I typically see a revenue benchmark. You know, a lot of times when I meet or mentor individuals who are getting started in their business, and there's this narrative that six figures is the holy grail, so they're working so hard for $100,000, and then they get it and realize that's not all that they thought it would be. So helping them to understand strategy shifts, so what you're doing as a lean business owner that's trying to get a few clients, when you know, that approach is different than once you get to, you know, cross $100,000, then your thinking shifts. I have quite a few clients who've hit the $250,000 mark and realized that they now need to replicate themselves in more of a business development function, and that's a huge shift. So not so much years, because I see everyone hits it at different times, but I do see trends as far as revenue benchmarks and focus and strategy. Individuals getting from $250,000 to $500,000 and then getting over $1 million, there's really unique challenges that hit at each one of those benchmarks from a sales perspective.
Yes, fantastic. Well said. Again, six figures, the business goals, and then $250,000 to $500,000. Anything else? I think this is really going to be key for listeners, especially freelancers and expert practitioners. Anything else on that list or in that bucket that folks should have their ear to the ground about or should be aware of, just based on your lens of doing this consulting work?
Yeah, you know, systems are critical. Systems for everything. So as a freelancer, structure creates freedom. So we want, oftentimes you become a freelancer because you want freedom to do the things that you love and you're passionate about, like you said, be your own boss, things of that nature. But structure creates that freedom. And what happens is when it's just you, you're doing everything in your business. And during that time frame, then, it's really critical that you're systematizing, you're documenting everything that you're doing. So when I'm working, whether I'm coaching, advising, regardless of what role they are in their business, one of the first keys is assessing what is, right? What already exists? How do we just audit what's already in place? Not to catch you with your hands in your cookie jar, but just to really identify what you're doing. Because a lot of times I realize business owners who are at, you know, early six-figure marks, they really don't know where their time is being spent, and that's really eye-opening for them. And then when you get to $250,000 marking, you're looking at bringing in someone else to help accelerate, shore up your revenue, that documentation is so critical, because now you can to someone, this is the process that's gotten us to where we are now. Here's the value proposition. Who are here? The buyers. Here are the templates for what I've been doing for success thus far. And you can transition someone else into that role. We perceive, I think there's a strong perception that someone who has a $1 million business has it figured out. And you would be shocked. I've had clients who are doing $2, $3, $4 million a year, and they still don't really have clear processes on business development. And just making that change gives them so much more oxygen in their business. So realize that how you do one thing is how you do everything. So if you start off your business with chaos, don't think more revenue is going to clear up that chaos. Do yourself a favor, bloom where you're planted, and start to create that structure now so you can have freedom later.
Bloom where you're planted. I love it. Oh my gosh. It's like the be an aspirin, not a vitamin. I love it. Bloom Where You're Planted is so clear. And on the art card where we've been promoting, Liz had said in one of her presentations, be an aspirin, not a vitamin. And if you're a strategist in, you know, creative communications planning, you totally probably get that. But Bloom Where You Planted is awesome. Yes, that's so good. Very good. Great. Let's keep going on new potential clients. So I find that I'm always on the phone, I'm always emailing, I'm always networking regardless. Again, I've been Alex's company for 11 years, and that new business prospecting never stops. And I got smart on that pretty quickly, you know, being a freelancer. But within your core competencies, you talk about that, you know, the mention of new potential clients. And I just think that's so huge and necessary. And bringing in new clients is ongoing and forever. And we just have to understand that that's a part of it, as to not put all of your rocks in one bucket all of the time. What do you agree with that? Do you think new business needs to be, prospecting needs to just be a part of it all the time, 100%?
Absolutely, without fail, without question. It is a part of a healthy, viable business. You know, if you're not bringing in new clients just through the door, you should start questioning what's happening with your business and why that's happening. That's definitely an indicator of a potential downward turn, right? So there's been studies that have been shown, and it varies based off of business, but typically you want to see 20 to 40% of your revenue coming from new business. Of course, if you're a brand new business, if you're a startup, obviously that's going to be 100%, and depending on how mature you are, it might be closer to 20%. But there should always be a pipeline of new business opportunities coming through your door. There have been also studies that have shown from a freelancer perspective, when a business loses 50% of businesses that lose a gorilla client, do not survive. If you really want to have stability, freedom, and really to have the peace of mind to focus on the skill set that led you to becoming a freelancer, you want to make sure that you have enough new business opportunities so that if Murphy's Law, you know, something happens, you always have new viable prospects to come in the door.
I think that's huge. And just the known, it's not a yes or no, it is a yes, that freelancers need to be consistently working on new business, and that being 20 to 40% of effort. Is that right?
Correct. Yep, your revenue. So you should typically see about, if you look at your business and you're doing, you know, $200,000 a year, when you look at that client base who brought in that revenue, you should see, okay, 40 to, you know, what is that, $80,000 of the $200,000 minimally came from new business. That lets you know you have a healthy, viable pipeline.
And what does that work out if you can, if this is a fair question, in terms of time? So if I want folks to be able to walk away with tangible things that they can do, you know, systems being one, new business, absolutely get over it, you got to do it, being two. Mm-hmm. In terms of time spent on filling the pipeline with new potential clients, what time in a week or in a month, however you consult with your clients, how much time in a week should folks be spending?
Absolutely. I think that's a great question. So I believe in calendar chunking, meaning that especially if you're a freelancer with, you know, fewer in every head in your business, you know, focusing time around certain activities so that you can really be at 100% and not distracted. Mm-hmm. So I focus on activity-based selling. Pipe Drive, if you ever go to pipedrive.com, they have amazing articles on what activity-based selling is. And so when I'm working with clients, it's not so much a focus on time, although I do tell them, if you're brand new, if you don't have a sales habit, minimally start off 2 days a week, 2 hours. So it might be Tuesdays and Thursdays from 9 a.m. till 11 a.m. That is my non-negotiable time to focus on revenue-generating activities. That means in the crazy chaos of my week and of my business, I know that minimally Tuesday and Thursday from 9 to 11 a.m., I am focused on the very things that help to bring revenue into my business. And so those things might be having proposal calls, presenting your solution, reaching out, you know, prospecting, calling, emailing, reaching out on LinkedIn. They're very focused efforts. It's not time to think about sales. It's not time to go to like a Chamber of Commerce and pass out business cards and call that a revenue generating activity. They are very specific activities that, you know, the things I'm doing right now are moving what I call moving the needle on sales. So if we were to look at sales as a process, right? So when you're prospecting, under prospecting, you're attracting, engaging, and converting basically a lead into an opportunity. So that's one. So we're attracting, engaging, and converting someone who doesn't know anything about us into someone who's now curious about what we do and wants to have a conversation. Then we move into discovery. Then from discovery, we're moving into proposing our solution. Then from that proposal, we're moving into closing that person. Depending on what happens in the close, we might be nurturing that person. And then eventually, hopefully, we're moving into onboarding them as a client. Mm-hmm. So in those time frames, we're looking at what can I do if I look at this bucket and I have this bucket of opportunity, individuals that I want to build relationships with. I'm focused on the things that are going to take someone from a prospect to discovery, from discovery to proposal, proposal to close, or I'm nurturing them. So they're very specific activities, and it's the discipline, because a lot of times, even well-intentioned people, when I'm coaching them, will look back at their month and they'll realize, I really only spent like 30 minutes on true revenue generating activities. I thought about it a lot. I avoided it a lot, but I didn't really spend time acting on it. So that's one habit. Another thing is we focus on activity-based selling. So the thing that I've always loved about sales is that your revenue has nothing to do with time. It has to do with effort. So if we focus on, I want 2 new clients a month, for my clients, we literally do the conversion number. So I just had a coaching call this morning where we were looking at, okay, well, if she has a bucket of 500 potential leads, and if we know that 30% of those are going to respond to our initial outreach message, then we know we have X amount. We were looking at, okay, so we need to do, we need 2 discovery calls a week in order to, at the end of the month, have 1 new client. So it's doing the reverse math, so you don't have to focus on time as much as, ooh, I should reach out to 30 people this week and with this message. And then from those 30 people, I should have 2 discovery calls on my calendar each week. So like doing the math, so you focus on the activity instead of watching the clock.
Yes, and I love the sales habit, just as a phrase in and of itself. You know, not focusing necessarily on the time, but the effort. That's great. On that note, and again, calling in a bit for freelancers here, income fluctuates with an ebb and flow, always an ebb and flow. Is that just the way it is? Are some businesses more scalable than others?
You know, consulting, and I put it under the bucket of consulting. Consulting has historically been a challenging business for feast or famine because you're trading your time for dollars, essentially. So that's always been a challenging business model for consistent revenue. What's really exciting, and this goes more into a pricing and positioning conversation than sales more sometimes, but it's a critical conversation I'm always having when a client is a freelancer, is you've got to find a way to productize what you do and package your offering so it's not focused on hours. So if I know that the way I productize what I do is it's a 90-day engagement, and if my contract is a 90-day engagement, and I know I have capacity to serve 5 clients in this 90-day engagement, then guess what? Then I know 45, really, before that, so let's just say, hypothetically, then 45 days into that client engagement, I know there's a risk this client is not going to upsell or renew at 90 days, so then I need to shore up my activities because now I'm going to have an open spot for a new client. So I don't think it's the way that business has to be. I just think because of the nature of who consultants are and freelancers are, they typically don't have sales support. Typically, sales is not their forte. And a lot of times they've been trading time for dollars. They don't have packages that give them forecasting ability. So when you productize it, when you have a business development focus, and when you understand your formula for these activities produce a new client, you then can forecast and say, okay, in June, I need to double my outreach because I'm going to have two openings in July, and I need to forecast and be prepared to bring in that revenue.
Let's keep going on building value-based relationships. It's a core pillar within your system and, you know, rooted specifically and more specifically in emotional intelligence. I love that your business development is rooted in emotional intelligence, you know, high-value relationship building and business acumen. Why not focus in on the role of emotional intelligence in building relationships? What would you say is the role of EI?
Yeah, emotional intelligence is your ability to tap into and really understand what someone else is feeling, what they value, being able to read, you know, their, not only what they're saying, but their nonverbal cues, and then to be able to adjust your communication style by putting yourself in the shoes of someone else. And it's critical. So when I talked about earlier, the stereotype of sales, you know, for many years, sales was a very aggressive, you know, we have all of these phrases we use, objections, how we overcome objections. You know, it was very aggressive. And I'm excited to see that because of the modern buyer, because sales people no longer drive the buying decision, and because the buyer is now in control in this digital world where they can self-educate, they can look at, quote, all the information they need to make a buying decision is typically at their fingertips. So at this point, the buyer is in control, which means that the modern seller has to adjust and adapt to that. And we then have to be buyer-centric and focus on how do we provide value to this person who can educate themselves and make a decision without including me? How do I insert myself in a way that provides value and influences this decision? And the only way to do that in this day and age where people can smell BS a mile away, they you know, they are looking for transparency and authenticity, is to really be able to tap into your emotional intelligence, think about that person's buying process, think about what they value, what they need to know to make an educated decision, and really serve them. So emotional intelligence is critical. I'm excited that sales is, as a profession, is moving more into a space of authenticity and serving the needs of buyers. As freelancers and as consultants, you have such a head up because buyers aren't looking to be sold. They're looking for trusted advisors. They're looking for individuals with a deep domain expertise. They're looking for subject matter experts to help them make sense of all. There's so much data, they're overwhelmed. So they're looking for someone, who is the person I can trust to advise me on this decision and help me get from point A to point B? And inherently, a freelancer is naturally skilled to do that because they are an expert at the service they provide. So by leveraging that expertise and then also developing emotional intelligence, you naturally are the best influencer.
Mm-hmm. Just reading on your website and your approach, it specifically attached to emotional intelligence is specifically attached to high value client relationships. I know across the board it's value and should be absolutely part of the mix. But is there a link between emotional intelligence and high value client relationship building specifically?
Yeah, so when I talk about high value clients, I'm typically referring to larger deal size as well as more executive buyers. Mm-hmm. So in that case, when you're talking about a B2B executive buyer who is considering a substantial buying decision, manipulation, aggressive tactics are not going to work with a savvier buyer. So emotional intelligence is critical because, one, it helps you to understand yourself, for you to have executive presence, to embrace yourself, to tap into your strengths so that you can be fully present in a conversation. And then, two, it helps you to focus on outcomes. Buyers buy outcomes. They don't buy what you do. They don't buy the features. They are buying a destination. So they're looking to get a specific outcome. And so emotional intelligence helps you to tap into, to really understand and hear what are the outcomes they're really buying, what is it they're really looking for, and then how to adjust adjust your communication in order to focus on the outcomes they're looking for, because it's about them, it's not about you.
Yeah, that end benefit is huge. And the phrase about people don't buy quarter-inch drills, they buy quarter-inch holes, you know, has stood the
Absolutely.
Test of time for sure. And to think about it in terms of outcome, that's very clear. What would you say is the role of technology as connected or not connected to building value-based relationships? So focusing in on technology.
Yeah, I think technology is a huge advantage for freelancers and consultants specifically, because typically when we look at the sales process, larger corporations had an edge because they had the resources or dollars to penetrate or saturate the market, if you will. And nowadays, technology is so accessible and affordable that now as a freelancer, you have access to the same decision makers as everyone else. It's actually, it's insane. It blows my mind when you really think about it. And then when we talk about structure creates freedom, sales to me is much more simplified because now you have so many tools that simplify the process and help you to work smarter, not harder. So for instance, if when I talked earlier about activity-based selling and knowing that, okay, I have 500 people that I'm looking to target and I know that I need to attract, engage, and convert them, and then I need to send them this message. So with CRM, so customer relationship management, I'll start here because I realize I take for granted and assume most people are using a CRM, and I found that most freelancers are not, that I encounter. So one is CRM. CRM is where anyone that is a potential buyer that you're having conversations with, that you're looking to bring into an engagement, you would then track, you would house that person's contact information and track and document your interactions with that person in a CRM. I will say Pipedrive and HubSpot are my two favorites for freelancers. If I had to pick one for a freelancer, I would probably say Pipedrive, because it is so intuitive and it's simpler. So for someone who doesn't want to spend a lot of time learning technology, Pipedrive is just very intuitive and it's built for that. You can get a free trial for 30 days and then it's like $15 per month. So it does a lot with the little, everything from recording your sales conversation so that you can have that to coach yourself and to really hear what you sound like and to give yourself feedback on how to improve your sales process. Mm-hmm. To actually, if you get off of a phone call, they will actually, you can put voice notes into Pipedrive and it will transcribe your voice notes into text for you. So if you're on the go and you get off a conversation and you're like, oh, let me hurry up and just do my voice memo to track what just happened in this conversation, Pipedrive will transcribe it into text and then save it under that person's information. So the next time you talk to this person, you have your notes. So I will say that CRM is critical because what's measured gets managed, and there's no way to improve something if you have no clue what it looks like today. So it's kind of like when you're looking at budgeting and they say to spend the first 30 days just tracking where all your money is going. That's what a CRM does for you. It just helps you to see what's happening. Is it normally taking? I've had clients who say, when we talk about what it takes to bring in revenue, they'll say, oh, you know, once I talk to someone, they're closed in 2 weeks. And then when we actually track it on CRM, we see, actually, you have a 4-month sales process. You just don't realize that's how long it's taking from initial conversation to close. Okay. So number one, I would say a CRM. And then number two, I will say, the CRM is for you internally to track. I will say, again, because it's buyer-centric, you need to be where your buyers are. So if you're in the B2B space, LinkedIn is a very critical place to make sure that you're maximizing the opportunities there. There are studies that have been shown that 84% of CEOs and VPs actually, their buying decisions are influenced based off of social media platforms like LinkedIn. There are also studies that have shown that executive decision makers look at 4 to 5 pieces of your content before they make a buying decision. So LinkedIn gives you access to those buyers to get their contact information, to influence them with your thought leadership, and things of that nature. So if I talked about tech, I would say they both two are critical starting points.
Let's keep going on proven business development, because it's part of the core competencies. And of course, everyone wants to pull back, you know, and understand it as far as ROI. And, you know, ROI has always been tough for service-based businesses. Is proven, when you say proven business approach, is proven based on ROI? What is proven?
Sure. Proven business development approach means that if you work the system, you will bring in new clients. So it's not a mystery. It's more of numbers. So, for instance, for each client that I work with, we work on their conversion numbers. So for sales, we should know, okay, our lead to discovery conversion might be 20%, and then discovery to proposal might be 40%. Proposal to close might be 45%. And so we build a system and a process around that. So it's proven. We have an approach. We know what works. And now it's just making sure that we're working the activities to produce that desired result.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get back. I had a follow-up question. We were talking about the ebb and flow of service-based businesses and consulting in particular. On that note, you know, how do you tackle the toughness of proving forward return on investment for service-based businesses? And let's take that, actually, let's do a different question first, and that's on consulting, because you specifically said consultants and subject matter experts. Anything to share in terms of helping those of us that are consultants and specialists in terms of ROI in a service-based business?
Absolutely. So, you know, we throw the word value around like confetti. And what I found is a trainer and a coach that most of us really don't all the way understand what value means for our business. It's one of those words that just becomes pretty vague and sometimes meaningless. So in the B2B space, your greatest competition is not the other consultant. It is status quo for your buyer. So when we're looking at proving ROI and understanding the value, it means that we have to understand status quo. And this is a very simple concept that I've worked with clients, and sometimes it takes them months to figure this out. I do full-day workshops helping people qualify and quantify the cost of the status quo. It's an easy concept that's very hard sometimes. But the idea is, people are resistant to change. And to sell something is to convince someone to change what they're doing so that they have the desired outcome that they say they want. So when you're looking to prove ROI, you have to understand the cost of doing business as usual and the impact you will have on business as usual so that you can quantify the return on the investment. So for instance, if I know that my solution is going to help you save 20% or save 20% of time. So if I know right now it's taking you 10 hours to do this, and I know that with my help it will only take you 8 hours, then what I do is we have to find a way to quantify those 2 hours, and then now that is the ROI. I promise no matter what you offer, there is an equation for that. And I spend VIP days doing that. So no matter where you're doing branding, strategy, training, whatever that solution looks like, you have to understand status quo well enough to then say, here's how I qualify. Qualify is what it feels like, because people make emotional decisions that they justify with logic. So people oftentimes care more about what it feels like, but then knowing how you quantify the ROI is what gets them signed on the dotted line. So if right now you're feeling overwhelmed, or you're having poor morale at your company culture, or whatever it feels like, I need to amplify that to let you know that I understand how it feels today, and then here's how it's going to feel after I provide you the solution. Here's the missed opportunity cost. Here's how much it's costing you today if you continue down the path of the status quo, and here's the ROI you're going to gain if you bring me in to change that. That's really where the secret sauce is. I'm known for saying I'm fluent in big money talk. Like, I have a shirt that literally says fluent in big money talk, and that's what I mean. There's studies that have been shown that 80% of people fail when they sell to executives because they do not know how to speak what I call big money talk, the language of big money talk, which is speaking the language of strategic high-value results and outcomes. In order to actually speak understand their world, understand the cost, what they're leaving on the table, and then be able to translate to them how you can get them to that future perfect reality.
Yes, absolutely. And speak the language of outcomes. Anything else to add on value-based relationships before we move on?
So what I'll just add is that, to your point, I always start with strategy. Before we jump in and do something, it's always with a strategy. So when we're doing the strategy session, when we're figuring out how we're going to approach new business growth, qualify and quantify the cost of the status quo is a critical part of that. But what's exciting then is once you've done that on the front end, to your point, Alex, you know, oh my gosh, like you become a true advocate and champion for everyone you interact with. And the better you understand those statistics, the more inclined you are to influence, because you're like, oh my gosh, if this is what they're leaving on the table, if it's costing them X amount of dollars, and I know my solution, the thing I take for granted, can help them with that, then it really becomes more about a relationship of, hey, whether we do business or not, I just want to make sure you understand this. I just want to make sure you have the resources, because it feels good to help and serve. And then what you'll find is that there's also studies that show that 74% of buyers do business with the first salesperson who adds value and brings insights to them. So by naturally knowing those statistics, understanding the status quo, and just advocating for how to create change for your buyers, they then are more inclined and want to do business with you. It just feels good. A lot of my clients tell me they don't feel like they're selling, and I say that all the time. I don't feel like I really sell. I teach, I educate, I help lead people through the uncomfortable part of change, but it's not like I'm twisting someone's arm. And the moment it feels like that, that's normally my sign that you're probably not my buyer, right? Because I want people who are just as excited to come to the table and work with me as I am to work with them.
I think that's huge. I think the feeling part of it, you know, a lot of times we don't necessarily talk about feelings in business, but again, just having the soft and hard to get to a place of advocacy is really huge. I like to use the funnel, marketing funnel ACUP, which is awareness, consideration, usage, and preference. And preference is there on purpose, tapping into word of mouth and, you know, shareable things that are spoken, that are shared from human to human, and in terms of recommendations.
I love that. I'm definitely going to borrow ACUP now. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So I noticed a few key headers within your services, and everyone listening, you can easily find that at stimulus.com. That's STIMULYST.com. A few key headers within services: Edge, Big Money Talk, and the U and USP. I want to give you some time here to talk about Edge, Big Money Talk, and the U and USP. Tell me a little bit about Edge. What is Edge, and if folks are listening and they're interested in your services, what should they know about Edge?
Yeah, so Edge is a partnership I have with Society Marketing Professional Services. So they're doing a series to help their marketers, just to educate marketers in their industry, which is more like the architectural, engineering, and construction space. And so in partnership with them, I'm doing training on LinkedIn for ways to really leverage LinkedIn for new business growth. So that's the series that they're doing. Big Money Talk, if you want me to go into that.
Yes.
Big Money Talk is what I hit on a little bit before. It's just a way to have fun, right? I was in a corporate field for some time, but now as a business owner, I like to have fun with the language. But Big Money Talk really was my way when I was working with a lot of freelancers. And I will highlight a lot of women, women business owners, freelancers, women consultants. I found that they were underpricing themselves and that they were not comfortable going after certain buyers. And so I was meeting brilliant, brilliant, brilliant practitioners. And then when I would get behind the scenes of their business, I saw a huge gap in how they were positioning themselves. And so Big Money Talk is kind of like just dealing with it and talking about how to close larger deals, and by speaking, like we talked about earlier, the language of strategic high value results and outcomes, and being unapologetic. I always say survival is selfish. I have a personal story that hit home. I had a personal struggle in my early 20s that shattered and changed my life. And what I found is that of us who have the skill set and ability to demand greater in the marketplace. I personally feel it's our responsibility to do so, not because of greed, but because we now can give from our overflow. And if you are a freelancer just getting by, you know, I've talked to enough to know that means that you are really just, you don't have enough stability oftentimes to give to others or to be concerned about others. So this Big Money Talk movement is about making sure that we're demanding our worth in the marketplace so that we can create a legacy, so that we can create change, and so that we can create companies and job opportunities and doing better business and promoting social causes. So that's my Big Money language and Big Money Talk.
Anything coming up on Big Money Talk as far as sessions or series? I think there's going to be a lot of interest in that. Is there anything on the docket for Big Money Talk?
Yeah, I'm looking at, so I've had a lot of demand as I prepare for 2020. I'm looking at end of this quarter hosting another, I call them B2B Big Money Workshop. Mm-hmm. And that is a day where we focus on positioning. So there's 8 critical questions that I help clients work through to get their positioning right for sales. One of those being, how do you qualify and quantify the cost of the status quo? That's one. That's normally the huge light bulb. Anyone who comes to that workshop is like, oh my gosh, that part of the training is where I had the biggest aha moment. So I have the B2B Big Money workshop that will be coming up. So if you follow me, you'll get notification of that. And then the second thing I'm working through is I've had people ask for group coaching. I understand sometimes for smaller businesses, price can be prohibitive. So we've been looking at a group coaching option to build community so that we're all working on growing our pipeline and bringing in new business together in a community setting. So stay tuned. That should be coming here shortly.
Very good. And following you on LinkedIn, is that the best way when you say follow you? What do you recommend as far as getting a heads up on some of these upcoming events?
Yeah, Liz J. Simpson on LinkedIn is perfect.
Okay, that's Liz J. Simpson. Obviously, you'll see her name, and I can include a link as well with the dialogue. Great. Last one here is the U and USP, and we mentioned that earlier, but what do these services encompass?
Yeah, U and USP is where I'm really doing workshops, training, and really talking about that you are the most critical part of your unique selling proposition. The first thing that people buy, you know, we talk about there's 4 stages to a sell. First, you're selling yourself, then you're selling time, then you're selling your expertise, and finally, you're selling your solution. And so the first thing that people are looking at is you. And so you are the most critical part of your service offering. There's so many studies that talk about, you know, how we judge someone's competence within a matter of seconds through nonverbal body language. So through the U and USP, that's where we tap more into what's your personality type? What's your DISC or your strength finder's profile? How do we strengthen your emotional intelligence? How do we amplify your personal branding? Because personal branding is now critical in this day and age. You know, people do not trust corporations, but they trust well-intentioned people. So really stepping into the role of being a personal brand, and then again, having your own personal value proposition. So the U and USP is really embracing the fact that people initially are deciding, do they know, like, and trust you? Mm-hmm. And then how do we use that knowledge to our benefit? Well, you're not in the business of marketing or freelancing. We're in the business of people, and we're in the business of building relationships. And so, but in this day and age, if I leave you with anything, people are looking for authenticity. They're looking for flawed people to show up who want to do business. You don't have to be perfectly polished. You just have to care.
I want to make sure that the right people are calling you. What's a typical starting point so that we can do what we can to make sure the right people are calling you?
I appreciate that thoughtfulness. As far as the right person, I will say I am a B2B person. So if you are direct to consumer or things of that nature, that's not my zone of genius. So I definitely want to hand off to people who do that day in and day out. My focus is if you offer a service and you're looking to get the attention of executives, you're looking for selling a solution that's minimally, you know, your lifetime client value is minimally around, you know, $10,000 or more, I'm more than the right person. I get excited about large deals and how to close those. As far as budget, I am Like I said, I'll be having the group coaching offering, the workshop. So there are different ways to engage me at different price points. So I would just say, if you're passionate about growing your business, if you want consistent new business growth, and you're motivated to do something about it, let's just have the conversation.
Okay, great. And the lifetime client value of $10K, extend on that for me. Is that...
Sure. So one is investment, right? So if you're going after clients and you know a client's only going to pay you $400 and that's it, it probably does not make sense to invest,
okay,
you know, thousands of dollars in it. Another reason why is the sales approach changes. So if I'm closing a smaller deal, it is more transactional based on the nature of the purchase, mm-hmm, whereas if I'm closing a deal that has a $10,000 value, now our sales process changes, it has different stages, and now because this person is making a larger purchase decision, there are different emotions they're navigating that as a salesperson you have to be prepared to lead them through. Mm-hmm. But that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Before we close out, anything else you want to share about your services or about sales in general? Anything that we should share before we do a final think and close?
I'm just so appreciative. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but I had a conversation with Alex a month ago, and Alex, you know that I'm a huge fan of who you are, the work that you're doing. I'm honored that you brought me on your platform to have this conversation. And to everyone listening, look, I know this is easy for us to talk about, but I know day in and day out that this is a challenge for a lot of people. So I just want to encourage you to breathe oxygen into your business, to grow it, because I know each of you are doing incredible things. And so having the capital and resources just gives you the ability to expand and emphasize your impact. So I'm wishing all of you the best that are hearing this, and I'm excited to hear about your stories and your passion.
Well, thank you again. It's been fantastic. And I know folks can't see because we do it over audio, but I'm blushing a bit on the kind words. It's absolutely my pleasure to share your brilliance. And we did hit it off right away on our first phone call. And so just, you know, this whole process has been very easy. And you talk about it, the key takeaway being authenticity. You're very, very authentic. And this conversation has been just that. And I think people are really going to have some tangible takeaways. So thrilled to help share the good word and to help freelancers who perhaps are progressing from, you know, those first 1 or 2 years into having some real profit and looking for ways to do better in areas where they're not as strong. So thank you again. Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.